Hosea chapter 9. Verses 1 through 6 come together. 1a. Israel is directly charged with spiritual adultery. In fact, the phrase used is very powerful. God says, because you've gone a whoring after other gods. So Israel's charged with spiritual adultery, breaking her marriage covenant with God. Remember, he had said to them in Isaiah, thy maker is thy husband. Breaking her marriage covenant with God. And 1b, you have proof of this. That is, for one, they liberally offered sacrifices to their idols while they begrudged God in their sacrifices to him. And I have in your sheets, often those that skimp on giving to God splurge when it comes to their own lusts. Often those that skimp in giving to God splurge when it comes to their own lusts. And secondly, as far as what they were charged with, they considered their state of prosperity as a reward, the word reward in verse 1, as a reward from their idol gods, from their false abominations, instead of turning around and giving greater credit to God. And therefore, the scripture says, rejoice not, O Israel. In other words, trouble or judgment is coming on its way. Psalm 73 verse 27 says, David says of God, thou hast destroyed all those that go a warring from thee. And that's why the Lord says, don't rejoice. 2a, verse 2a, the land is either going to be blasted by the hand of God or plundered by the hand of man. Therefore, you find in the second half of verse 2, there will be no more new wine. Wine, a symbol of gladness and joy. Your joy is going to cease. You've gone a warring. There'll be no more new wine. Your joy will cease. Destruction's going to come upon you. 3a, first half of verse 3. This is a beautiful phrase. God says, now where are they living? This is the book of Hosea. This is long after Israel has come to possess Canaan, the promised land. And God is so beautifully reminding them and saying through the prophet, this is the Lord's land. Just because you're Jews and people of Israel, it's not your land, it's the Lord's land, is the phrase there. This is the Lord's land. And in the Chaldee, it literally means the land of the Shekinah. See, it was only in the nation, to the nation of Israel, the oracles of God were handed. The law, the commandments were given. And it was only in the nation of Israel that the Ark of the Covenant of God rested. And it was there that the very Shekinah glory of God dwelt. You remember from my classes, Shekinah means simply the immediate presence of God. We know he's omnipresent, but that was where the immediate presence of God was. So God is saying, this is the Lord's land. It is the place or the land of the Shekinah of God. The land of the Shekinah. And God is saying to them, the land is mine, but Israel, you have abused it. Therefore, I will turn you out as bad tenants. You have a tenant if you rent a place and they abuse the place. You're going to work on evicting them. You have abused the land, out you're going to go. All God's promises are conditional. If we will not obey, we cannot inhabit his land or experience the blessings of his love. They will be cut off. In verse 3b, again you have references to Egypt and Assyria. Egypt, again, the type of bondage. And when those who are captured and taken as captives into Assyria, they will be like the prodigal, reduced to a mean estate with unclean foods to eat because of their poverty. You know how sticky the Jews can be about kosher food. But when you're captives and in poverty, you can't be that much of a stickler anymore. Verse 4, let's read that. Chapter 9, verse 4. They shall not offer wine offerings to the Lord, neither shall they be pleasing unto him. Their sacrifices shall be unto them as the bread of mourners. All that eat thereof shall be polluted, for their bread for their soul shall not come to the house of the Lord. They shall not offer wine offerings. They will be in such poverty-stricken conditions when in captivity to the Assyrians, they will hardly have any meat or money for meat offerings, let alone liquid or wine offerings. It says, they shall not offer wine offerings to the Lord, neither shall they be pleasing unto him. If they have even wine offerings to pour out before God, why will they be not pleasing to God? There's a reference I have here for you from Deuteronomy 26:14. The children of Israel were forbidden to eat holy things when in mourning. Now they're in captivity, reduced to poverty, which is a perpetual state of mourning. Which means if you're in a state of mourning, you can't eat the holy things of God. So look at the condition they're in when they are reduced to such a base level and they want to turn back to God, but they're in mourning, you're not supposed to eat things holy. So what they want to offer is not pleasing or acceptable to God because their bread is polluted since they're in a state of mourning. And their bread for their soul, that phrase means they barely have enough to eat or to starve. The very sustenance, the staples, the basics. So either they offer that or they starve. Verse 5. What will they do then as a nation? Israel, what will you do then on your feast days, that is on your Sabbath days, on your special holy days? What are you going to do? How will you celebrate? How will you offer? Then they will begin to prize the spiritual bread when they would experience a famine of it. Now they want to offer and it's not acceptable. Verse 6 A and B. Assyria will attack and destroy them from the northeast. Israel flees to Egypt to perish. Exodus 14 verse 11, when the first time they were in bondage to Egypt, says, they will find graves in Egypt. Even though they may flee to Egypt literally as refugee status, fleeing from the oppressor Assyria, they will still be without all of their possessions and they will find graves there. And there's another city mentioned, Memphis shall bury them. At that time, Memphis was a big city in Egypt. Even in Memphis, they go there, they're going to die in that land. And remember, any refugee always has fond hopes of going back to his home country to visit when things are better perhaps. But they will find graves there, they will die there, they will be buried there. They can't escape from God's judgments. Verse 6, the second half, C and D. Even if these refugees return from Egypt, they will find that their pleasant places of silver or their dwellings are now in ruins. And the scripture says that the pleasant places of silver are overgrown with nettles. Again, a challenge to us. Let us beware lest we put our trust in our money. They come back to their safety vaults, to whatever they had, to whatever they possessed. It's overgrown with nettles. Verses 7 through 10 come together. 7a. The phrase in 7, for they have, the days of visitation are come, the days of recompense are come. This is not future tense. It's going to come. Beware. No, it's now, here. It is come. It's at hand. The judgment is not future. It's in the now. 7b, what Israel did not know, because Israel did not know, they did not learn by instruction, they will now learn by experience. If we don't learn by hearing, then experience is one of the greatest teachers. Someone said, the wise learn from others' mistakes, the prudent learn from their own mistakes, and fools, no, the wise learn from others' mistakes, the prudent learn from their own mistakes, and fools don't even learn from that, something to that effect. But if Israel would not learn, would not know by instruction, and they flew in the face of their prophets, like in Hosea's face, then they would have to, they'd be forced to learn by experience. That was verse 7. They go on to say, you find these two words used for the prophets, fools and madmen. Now either this is what the children, the rebellious children of Israel, called the true prophets of God, or it has to be taken to mean the false prophets, the lying flatterers that spoke positively to them when doom was on their heels. So fools and madmen, either to the prophets that they, the true prophets of God that they rebelled against, or the names for the lying flatterers. Now, why would they be deceived by lying flatterers? Because, you see the phrase in verse 7, of their sin and hatred for God's law and the prophets. Verse 8a. God intended, you see the word watchman there. God intended for Israel to be as a watchman with him. In other words, be in constant fellowship and communion with me, Israel, my people. But instead, in 8b, you find Israel departed from him, rejected God, rejected the truth, and instead of them being a light to the nations around them, they became a snare to those nations. Initially, they adopted the gods and idols of those nations, but then we covered in the last chapter just now that they made their own idols. Instead of them being a light to the nations, they became a snare to the other nations. Verse 9. To get the whole impact of this, you'll have to do some homework by going home and reading Judges chapters 19 and 20 to get the impact of Hosea chapter 9 verse 9 and Hosea chapter 10 verse 9. They both hit the same city and the same people. But to put it in a nutshell, in those two chapters, there's a Levite who took to himself a concubine, and then he came to the city of Gibeah, which is within the tribe of Benjamin. And this concubine, some men of Gibeah came at night and asked the host to bring the man out so they may know him. Homosexuality. But the host said, please don't. And they eventually ended up giving his concubine to these men. They abused her, it says, the whole night. In the morning he came and the woman was down, face down on the threshold of the house. And he said, get up, let's be going, because he was only there overnight. But she did not respond. She was dead. It's quite a gory story where he cuts her body then into 12 pieces and sends one part to each of the 12 tribes of Israel. And then Israel finally comes back. But the tribe of Benjamin backed the people, the men of Gibeah, who did this. It was in their territory. And so Israel gathered together. They wanted these men to be handed up, but Benjamin backed them up. Israel stood them in three attacks, and the third attack, they were so successful, Israel slew every single man from the tribe of Benjamin except 600 that fled to the hills. And from 600 men, the tribe of Benjamin had to rebuild all over again. In fact, they slew the women and children. They had to get virgins from some other tribe that did not participate in the battle to give them as wives to these 600 men to reestablish the tribe of Benjamin. But such was the gross sin of the people or the men of Gibeah, and they were backed by Benjamin. Now, both these chapters, verse 9, will make some sense. 9. They have deeply corrupted themselves as in the days of Gibeah. Therefore, he will remember their iniquity. He will visit their sins. Israel, you thought from your history that Gibeah, the men of Gibeah, were grossly sinful. You now, who attacked and defeated Benjamin, are no better than them. You're just as bad, if not worse. And only 600 men were spared. How much do you expect to be spared by God, says the prophet? God's judgment is sure. They've sunk to the depths of spiritual depravity. Verse 10 A and B, there's a beautiful analogy here where God reflects upon the very foundations of the nation of Israel to some wild grapes or first ripe figs. Important phrase, first ripe figs. Why this picture? In Jeremiah chapter 24 verse 2, good people are compared to good things that are first ripe. In other words, if you planted not a crab apple, a real fruit-bearing apple tree, golden delicious or something. Okay, now it's a young plant, and then there's always the very first year when it bears fruit. That first crop of apples, there's a phrase here that I'd like, those are what we call first ripe. Good people are compared to good things first ripe. One of those then is worth much more than many afterwards in successive years. The first fruits from the first crop of that new tree. And God is reflecting through the prophet, Israel, you were as wild grapes or as first ripe figs. So precious, so tender, so delicious you were. Look where you have fallen today. 10c, it says, you have gone so low as to worship Baal Peor, went to a dirty dunghill deity, similar to these beautiful first ripe figs contracting a disease and rotting, getting from bad to worse. And then verses 11 through 17 of this chapter 9 come together. It deals with Israel's sterility and coming exile. Verses 11 and 12 together, Ephraim and Manasseh were the two sons of Joseph. Jacob had 11 sons, so there should have been 11 tribes, but you take Joseph out and put his two sons in. Joseph means fruitful. Ephraim means doubly fruitful. Doubly fruitful. And geographically, where the tribe of Ephraim was located was extremely fertile, very, very wealthy patch of real estate. Literally goes along with the name, doubly fruitful. But so great was their sin, Ephraim's, that they will be struck doubly. First themselves, well, Ephraim also deals, stands for the nation of Israel in this whole book. First, by themselves, they will be struck by God. And second, in their offspring, there would be a high infant mortality rate. And even if there be children that survived, they would still not be protected by their parents. We'll see that the parents go so grossly into sin as to practice child sacrifices to idols. So even if the children survive, they will still not even be protected by what we would consider the parental love and care that a child should expect. Verse 13 says, even as Tyre, now Tyre was a very prosperous city, so also was Ephraim. I just said she was doubly fruitful, very wealthy. But she even got involved in human sacrifices of her own children to idols. Verse 14, if that be so, then that very sin is its own punishment. You lose your own children. The Lord himself doesn't have to directly intervene. That gross sin is punishment in itself. But the prophet Hosea is asking God to avert or to avoid this by not even giving them children. Why let them bear children, Lord? If they're going to have a high infant mortality rate, or they're going to miscarry or cast away from the womb, or why let them have children if even when they grow up they're sacrificing them to idol abominations? Now you recall when Jesus said in Luke 23:29, blessed is the womb that never bore and the paps that never gave suck. There will be times in the history of our world when it would be better almost not to have the children than to have them to be born and to go through such things. Verse 15, and here's quite an interesting thought about Gilgal. All their sin or all their wickedness is in Gilgal. Apparently, Gilgal was like the headquarters for sin and idol worship. It's also found in Hosea chapter 4, verse 15, chapter 12, verse 11, and in Amos 4, 5. We read that once before. The entire succession, I mentioned this earlier, of the kings of the northern kingdom of Israel did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. And finally, they were driven out. Now, on your sheets, if you follow, the Hebrew name for the city was Gilgal. But in Syriac, Gilgal spells Golgotha. Maybe there was some mystical prophetic sense by the prophet Hosea, 400 plus years before the time of Jesus. All their sins, the headquarters of the sins of this planet, is focused and concentrated on Golgotha, which we know it bears no explanation. Verse 16. This verse in itself is a combination of verses 10, 11, and 14. It has thoughts from all those three verses. Israel referred to as wild grapes, first ripe figs, which are now dried and withered, about sacrificing their children to the demon. The demon god was Moloch, and that was its own punishment. Verse 17, the last verse in this chapter. Israel becomes a castaway. She is disinherited, dispersed throughout the nations of the world. After this attack by Assyria, after this captivity, listen to this. The nation of Israel, the 10 tribe northern nation, never ever came back together, not even up till today. People still have disputes. Bible scholars talk about where are the lost tribes of Israel. James 1:1, suddenly this will become light to us. James writes that epistle to the scattered tribes of Israel. So maybe they still had an idea where they were when James wrote. Today we don't know. just a little personal perspective, I feel that those who strive to say, well, England is one of the lost tribes, France is one, I think maybe those persons are suffering with an identity crisis or a self-image problem. Just don't worry about it. Because in Revelation, I think it's in chapter 7, verses 4 through 8, it says that Jesus, or God then, will have, 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes of Israel for the 144,000. He knows where they are, all right? What matters is we are circumcised in our hearts, we're born again, we're sealed with the Spirit of God, we'll be in heaven together. But since then, they never came back together. Those 10 tribes have been dispersed. Chapter 9. I'm sorry, we just finished chapter 9. Chapter 10. Hosea chapter 10, verses 1 and 2 come together. Israel is portrayed as an empty vine. Verse 1, the word empty, the Hebrew word is bakak, B-A-Q-A-Q. We don't spell that way in English, a Q is always followed by a U. Bakak, it's an onomatopoetic word. Now here's what it means. How does a bee go? Buzz. What does a snake do? Hiss. Those are called onomatopoetic words. That is, the word itself sounds like what it's talking about. So in Hebrew, bakak is an onomatopoetic word, which means like the bubbling or the gushing of a spring, bakak. But it has another meaning also, and using the intransitive sense here, it also means spreading or luxuriant. Now it says Israel is as a spreading or luxuriant vine. We just covered that Ephraim was doubly fruitful, right? Instead, however, of crediting God for her blessings, in her delusion as a nation, in her delusion, she credits her idol gods even more, she credits. Verse 2, therefore both the altars they built and the idols they worship will be completely destroyed. They are called faulty in verse 1 and 2, Israel, or guilty, and her heart divided. You remember the incident with wise King Solomon? And the two women, one slept, killed her baby at night, and so she took the others. The one who was not the true mother said, let us divide the child. And that's just like Satan. Worship God. Go to church. That's fine. But also worship me. And that's, her heart was divided, like Satan was like the pretended mother. Divide your lusts and affections. But God says, I'll have all or none. I'll have none of it, for I am a jealous God. And my glory will I not give or share with any other, let alone Satan himself. I'll take it all. Take it all, says God. I'll have none of it. Either all or none. Verses 3 through 10. Israel is shown in a state of anarchy. Verse 3. This condition of anarchy arises because of defection. Israel's defecting from Jehovah God. And they realize that now, even if they had a king, it would be no use, for these judgments are coming from God. You read verse 3, you'll pick that out. Verse 4, Israel is accused of being unfaithfulness and deceitful, and that these traits are rampant throughout the land. And it's similar to the word used in verse 4 is hemlock. Hemlock is a noxious, toxic, extremely poisonous weed. In fact, for some history buffs, the Greek philosopher Socrates, they gave him hemlock to drink. That was their mode of capital punishment. Unfortunately, he didn't deserve to die, but he drank it and died. So just as when the farmer expects good corn in the fields, God looks at Israel and sees hemlock, such toxins growing right there, deadly poison. Verse 5, those of Samaria who trusted their golden calf at Beth-Aven, we covered that before, Bethel means house of God, Beth-Aven means house of idols, house of vanity, house of iniquity. So those of Samaria who trusted the golden calf at Beth-Aven, both the people and priests will be in dismay and sorrow as it, that is that golden calf, will be carried away as a present or rich booty. Now it's pure gold. To King Jareb, which was the nickname of one of the kings of Assyria at that time. Now, what gods or security do they have left? What god, what calf is there left? None. What security? If their security was in the gold in that calf, gone. In their riches, it's gone. So now who do they have to turn to? Whatever earthly glory they thought they possessed with that calf and with its gold and with its riches, they were now worse off, because even the glory of God had departed. Ichabod. I have a reference there What book is it from in your note sheets? Do I have a reference there? It's in Judges. Well, it takes place right where Eli, his two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are killed in battle by the Philistines. He gets the news, he falls down, breaks his neck, and dies. The younger son, Phinehas' wife, was pregnant and expecting. She delivers when she hears that her labor pains come upon her. She delivers and says, call him Ichabod, meaning the glory of God is departed. Because when the Philistines defeated the Israelites then, they took away the ark. Ichabod. So here the golden calf was gone, but that wasn't all that bad. The worst thing to happen was that God's glory had departed from Israel. 6b, God's ark or altar. Here's a precious thought. As long as they were true to Jehovah God, the ark of the covenant and the temple worship of the altar was never destroyed or ruined. But when they were worshiping idols, when they were unfaithful to God, the temple, the ark was taken away. But when they were faithful to the calf, it was broken down, captured, and taken away. But God is showing them a lesson. As long as they're faithful to me, you'll be blessed. As long as you worship false gods, when you're in contempt of me, there's a curse. When you venerate those idols, there's a curse. Verse 7, the kings are called foam, as froth. These false kings that did the king that did evil in the sight of God, like froth on troubled waters, these ungodly kings are compared to, or as mere scum on the surface of water. Or think of a bubble of foam, it's sparkling and glistening, but inside it's hollow and empty. And so these kings that do not serve God are going to be cut off, like bubbles of foam. Verse 8 talks about the high places. I covered this just now, the last chapter. The high places, it says in verse 8, were overgrown with thorns and thistles. These high places where they had their grottos, their groves, their idols, and under shady trees and elevated places where they came to worship these demons and these gods are now overcome. These high places were like thistles and nettles, like thorns in the sight of God and good men. Now, they are literally reduced to just that. Thistles and thorns and overgrown with them. But yet you find that Israel would rather die than to repent with the severe judgment and the stubbornness of their hearts. Verse 9, I covered this with the last chapter. 9:9 and 10:9 deal with Gibeah. So you've got the whole spiel with what Gibeah is. As Gibeah was grossly sinful, so now they were called the children of iniquity, Gibeah. But now God calls Israel the children of iniquity. They've sunk so low. And so they can expect destruction. Verse 10, God must and he will punish Israel. The question is when or why? For her double entrenchment into sin. There's a phrase there in verse 10, for her two furrows. The Hebrew word for furrow is awon, A-W-O-N, awon, meaning in their adhering to their two cohabitations. Literally, that means with their two sexual partners, two furrows. But it's a direct inference to the two golden calves at Dan and Bethel. God is calling it fornication, spiritual whoredom. They've gone a-whoring from their God. And so doubly, as they worship these two, so doubly shall their judgment come upon them. And then verses 11 through 15 come together. Israel is compared to a trained heifer. Another good analogy. A trained heifer. Verse 11, Ephraim, or Israel, had the status of being the most favored nation. Of every country in the world, Israel was that most favored nation by God. And it was so wealthy, I talked to you about being doubly fruitful. And the word says, muzzle not the ox that treads the corn. She's compared to a trained heifer. The ox that treads the corn gets as much as it wants to eat as long as it's treading the corn. Such was Israel, a trained heifer. They could eat much, could eat freely. But her privileged status is lost. Assyria conquers her, and Assyria rides on her back. She was a beautiful trained heifer doing a good job. Now she has a conqueror riding her back, Assyria. And Judah, I mentioned, 130 years later by Babylon. Verse 12, I'll deal with at the end. That's a good verse to finish with, like dessert. Let's go to verse 13. Israel has taken great pains in serving her idol gods. What else could she expect to reap now? She will reap, the verse says, the fruit of lies, similar to good, fair, first ripe fruit, which is outside beautiful, but now rotten on the inside, the fruit of her lies. And thy way, God's accusing her of her stubbornness, self-willed, thy way, her way, and because she trusts in the arm of flesh that was the neighboring kings and nations. Verse 14, there's a king named Shalman. His name is not mentioned anywhere, but there is an Assyrian king called Shalmaneser. All scholars agree that this is who Hosea is referring to. This king Shalmaneser was an Assyrian king, and this particular invasion of his is not mentioned anywhere else in scripture, which is okay. But it was very fresh in the recent memory of the local people at a place called Beth Arbel, meaning House of Arbel. The invasion was so terrible, so bloody, ruthless and cruel that even the mothers with children were smashed and killed. The reason for that height of brutality was perhaps to instill fear so that other rulers would yield and surrender even before he got there. And that's some of the judgment. 15a, note here, God says, so shall Bethel do to you. God does not say, so shall Assyria do to you. God does not say, so shall the king of Assyria do to you, even though he was the agent. God says, so shall Bethel do to you. This is not coming upon you because of Shalmaneser, not because of Assyria, not because of the king of Assyria, but because of Bethel, the house of God. You put an idol and worship it. That's the reason why. So shall Bethel do to you. So shall your sin do to you. It is their own sin that destroys, ruins, and reproves them. 15b, here's the name on your sheets, Hoshea, Hosea. Saul was the first king of Israel. Can I quick give you, I have a couple minutes yet. I just told you, Saul was the first king of Israel. What was the first king of Israel doing when the prophet Samuel found him and anointed him? He was looking for his father's donkeys that were lost. Who was the last king of Israel? Jesus Christ. He also came to look for his father's donkeys which were lost. That's free. Okay. But there's a whole message on donkey and a beautiful parallel to the Christian sometime maybe. Okay. Where was our verse? 15. Hosea was the last physical, literal king, not counting Jesus now, of Israel. And after he was cut off, there was never again a king to sit on Israel's throne. Remember I said they never came back as a gathered nation again. He was cut off, finished, that ended it. It says, in a morning, or in other words, as surely as morning comes, in less than a day's time, in a very short time, Israel will be cut off. Her last king will be cut off. And now verse 12 to end out this chapter. The only preventive solution for Israel is, in the middle of that verse it says, it is time to seek the Lord. Israel, wake up, Hosea is saying. It's time. It's high time. Now is the time. Today is the day of salvation. Harden not your heart. It's time, high time to seek God. And in the first line of 12, verse 12, he says, sow to yourselves in righteousness. The only way to hold off God's judgment and to bring on his blessings is by a way, is by a life of righteousness. And as a nation, we know that righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. Sow to yourselves in righteousness. Reap in mercy. Even when we live a life of righteousness, what we reap as blessings is not because of our own merit, but because of God's mercy. Because even our merit or righteousness, Isaiah says, is as filthy rags in the sight of God. But God's saying, if you will live a life of righteousness, out of my abundant grace, I will bestow my mercy upon you. 12b, last half of this verse. Break up the fallow ground. My Chambers Dictionary says that fallow means land that has lain a year or more untilled, or after tilling it, you leave it without sowing. What's the point? Fallow, land that has lain a year or more untilled or unsown after being plowed. And so long has Israel lain spiritually bankrupt and wasted, with a heart growing harder and harder as it's not sowed and tilled and used and bringing forth fruit. Break up the fallow ground. Break it up. Soften your hearts. Take out that heart of stone. Put in a heart of flesh. Let me do that. Seek the Lord while he may be found. And he will come, says this verse 12, to rain righteousness on you. Israel, if you will turn, if you will live a life of righteousness, now is the time to seek me. I will rain righteousness. You won't be able to contain it. It will be showers of blessing. You'll be drenched in my blessing, Israel. Church, you will be drenched in my blessing, says God. But there's one different meaning for the word rain righteousness. The Hebrew word is yara. That also sounds onomatopoetic. Yara. It's like yara. Rain. It also means I will show you, I will teach you, I will instruct you in the ways of righteousness into a